Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz. As we mentioned in our last edition, the legislature is starting to spend more time in its respective chambers voting on bills that have emerged from committee. Keeping an eye on this activity are our Pulse regulars, Maine Public's State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler and Chief Political Correspondent Matt O'Leary. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good morning. Morning.
Steve Missler, you've noticed that many of the bills that are being taken up at the moment have a social or cultural component, bills like the one to have Medicaid cover abortions and such.
There's certainly a health care component to several of these. Some of them haven't quite reached here yet, such as the vaccination bill, which would potentially eliminate religious and philosophical exemptions. That's still very much in flux. But there's a pretty good chance that that bill will arrive at her desk in some iteration. And then, of course, as you just mentioned, the bill to allow for taxpayer-funded abortions through the Medicaid program. What's interesting about these is that they are definitely bills that are sort of statements of Democratic voters' values. And they are the type of bills that will energize support among Democrats, sort of pacify them, if you will. I mean, these are a lot of the things that Governor Mills ran on, maybe not taxpayer-funded abortions specifically, but there's certainly the abortion issue is something that, and expanding access to those is certainly something Governor Mills has talked about when she was running. But what's interesting about that, too, is it's had an effect of energizing her opponents. I've noticed over the last few weeks and months, even in the State House, that there's a lot of conservative activists that are here on any given day to fight these issues. Now, that's different from what I've experienced here over the last 8 years when we had a Republican governor, and a lot of these conservative demonstrations or protests were really few and far between. So what we have now is, you know, mobilized opposition. It was here today for a slate of gun bills, for example. What's interesting about all that is I kind of wonder at what point do the Democrats that control the legislature and Governor Mills pass bills that are not just to these more narrow constituencies, but perhaps broader in appeal to the state writ large?
It's really kind of following the normal practice of the legislature. The big money issues, the ones that affect most people, things like school funding, are still part of the budget. The budget is still being worked on. There's a lot of agreement on the budget. We're getting down to the last 20% that they're going to fight about. But those sorts of issues are very much at the end of the session. What we're seeing now is similar to what we saw under LePage, in that some of the social bills, if you recall, his bills dealing with, for example, tightening up welfare. Those were early on in his sessions. And as for the conservatives coming out, they are certainly coming out. I was at the rally by probably 75, maybe 100 folks who are supporting gun rights, in which they went after Governor Mills and her swamp creatures, as they called them, who are trying to take away the gun rights of Mainers. So that kind of rhetoric is already heating up. And I suspect we're going to see some very heated rhetoric going forward. And all that stuff, they really need to get out of the way before they fight about the budget. Mm. Because the budget is the one thing they have to do. Mm. They have to have a budget to run state government for the next 2 years.
And Mal, it's not really surprising, is it, that in a legislature and an executive branch at the moment that's dominated by Democrats, that we're going to see more protests by conservative-leaning Republican groups? I would imagine that was true the past 8 years for Democrats when they were out of power.
Absolutely. There were all kinds of rallies in the Hall of Flags and press conferences in the Welcome Center and some rallies outdoors, if you recall, for things like solar power. So, yes, you're absolutely right. The folks that are on the out are using the bully pulpit of press conferences and rallies to try to get their arguments across, knowing full well that around this place, everything only lasts 2 years. And we've got another legislature that will be elected next year, believe it or not, and attempts by Republicans to try to bring those folks back. Yeah. At the rally this morning, you had Bruce Poliquin, former Republican congressman from the 2nd District, who was working the crowd, and he was telling people, you know, got to get out there. You got to work. We got to win this next election.
Yeah, well, I think what's interesting, too, about and what may be a little bit different from the conservative protest perspective is that you've often heard Republicans in the main Republican Party lament the fact that they haven't had in the past like a cohesive sort of strategy or activists group that turn out on a regular basis. I don't know if they've what we've seen here is a manifestation of that desire, but it's certainly something that's a little bit different, at least from my experience covering the state house. It is a bit interesting to see conservatives turn out and be organized about it. And I think that that's something that they've been pining for. So it's a bit of a platform in that sense. And it's also a way for conservative activists to just be able to organize and turn out and make their voices heard.
In many ways, it's a reflection of what's going on nationally, where you're seeing more hyperbole on both sides, both conservatives and progressives, and they're clashing and they're fighting and they're fighting their issues out. And in many ways, that's led to some problems in Congress with gridlock because you got to compromise to get something through when you've got a Republican Senate and a Democratic House. Here it's a little different where the Democrats control both, but to get any important legislation such as a bond package, let's say, through the budget, you're going to have some Republican votes. So there's going to have to be some compromising here between the Democrats and Republicans.
Another big issue that's been emerging in the last couple of weeks is about what isn't going to happen in road and bridge construction. Higher than expected bids for projects have caused the state to postpone until later years more than a dozen bridge repairs or road repaving projects. I was struck by an AP story that reported Republican legislators were arguing the state should spend more money to keep these projects on track. I gather that's not really in the cards, is it?
It doesn't appear that way. I mean, MDOT has basically taken the position that they're not going to accept bids that are, 30, 50, 60% higher than what they put out, for projects. A, that's probably a fiscally prudent thing to do because, as we all know, transportation budgets are already pinched. I mean, we've kind of become a state that's heavily reliant on going to voters for bond because the money that we get from the gas tax is just not enough for capital projects. So, I mean, the political ramifications of that, though, are interesting. Even though DOT's decision to do this makes some sense from a fiscal perspective, it may not from a political one. And that might be why you're hearing from Republicans saying we should go ahead and do these projects anyway. And the reason for that is that roads and bridges is the government that all of us see and feel. When I'm driving home in Brunswick and I'm driving on Route 1 and I'm half expecting weeds to start sprouting out of these massive cracks in the road, then the roads there are as bad, if not worse, than other parts of the state. I see that. I feel that. And that's a very powerful thing. And I think Republicans understand that. I've heard that in private conversations I've had with Republican lawmakers. They think that this is an opportunity for them to highlight perhaps the failings of the Mills administration, even though you could argue that she's inherited some policies or lack thereof that did not address the DOT funding issue. A lot of times you hear Democrats complain about Governor LePage's reduction in municipal revenue sharing, which is why local roads stink, right?
So. And Republicans are pointing out the Democrats here are trying to have it both ways. I mean, Janet Mills is doing the same thing LePage did, and that is proposing a $100 million bond issue that will be paid for by the general fund in order to build these projects because no one wants to say, yes, I'm for a gas tax increase, a fuel tax increase, a mileage fee on everyone, any of these options that would generate enough money to repair the roads and repair the bridges. That's going to be with us for this session. And I think the Republicans are there going, well, maybe we can put Janet Mills and the Democrats in a box so they raise a tax. And she would then be forced, to defend that come 3 years from now when she's up for re-election. So we all drive on the roads. We all know how bad they are. We probably all filled in the little contest about where's the worst pothole. My favorite's right here at Western Avenue in Augusta. I'm sure Steve's got one down in Brunswick. This problem has got to be addressed, and no one wants to address it because it takes money.
All right. And lastly, there are some signs Governor Mills is beginning to get pushback on legislation from some in her own party.
Well, we had two examples. I'll start with the most recent one, which is the vote in the Maine Senate to ratify or at least initially pass a bill that would do a climate assessment of this very controversial Central Maine Power transmission line project. The governor supports that project. She hasn't come out and said she's going to veto this particular bill, but she's said that she doesn't think that we need an additional study to evaluate the climate benefits of this proposal. Democrats in the legislature and Republicans, too, don't feel the same way. And we had a vote of 30-4, which was a real statement vote. And if a similar margin is carried in the House of Representatives, which it needs to by virtue of the fact that it's an emergency legislation, and you need 2/3. If they get a supermajority in the House, that would really set up this, I think, a doomsday scenario for the governor in which, you know, she's going to be put into a position of having to veto a bill that is supported by a supermajority of the legislature. And she may not want to do that. I mean, I've had some private conversations with various supporters of hers or people in her administration, and they're concerned about the optics of her being on the opposite side of a Democratic-controlled legislature's position, especially if it's bipartisan, and it so far is. So we've already seen, as Mal pointed out, that Democrats are already willing to go against the governor on an ethanol bill, where they didn't actually override her, but 31, I think, was the number.
Four votes.
They almost overrode her by 4 votes. And 31 Democrats joined Republicans in that override. And I think that may be may foreshadow what we see potentially on the CMP bill.
The reality is we've always seen clashes from governors when they have majorities in the legislature, no matter who they have been. And when we're seeing this, it's starting to bubble to the top. For example, there's a bill out there getting all kinds of support to increase the amount of money for education to bring us up to that magical 55%. That's $157 million, Irwin. Mm. There's no money to do that. The progressives in the Democratic Party are pushing that bill. They are pushing restoration fully of municipal revenue sharing. Again, a big ticket item, which there's no money to fund. So you're going to have Janet Mills, the Democratic governor, going up against a big chunk of her party who wants to spend more money than there is to spend.
But in the case of bills like the one Steve was talking about a few moments ago that look like they might pass over the governor's objections, she does have something else she can do to kind of indicate displeasure. She can let legislation become law without her signature. You know, she can signal to some people, I didn't like this, but on the other hand, she doesn't have to suffer a veto override.
Having covered Janet Mills for a long time, I don't think that's an option, Irwin, that she's going to take. She's either going to sign it or she's going to veto it. She once described that as wishy-washy to me back when another governor had let a bill become law without their signature. So I just don't see her doing that. I see her making a decision, yes, this is worth signing, or I'm going to veto it because it's bad.
Mal Leary and Steve Missler, and that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. The Pulse podcast is posted each Friday afternoon, and you can access it anytime at mainepublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Past podcasts are also available. The Pulse also airs Sundays on Weekend Edition, and we air an abbreviated version Mondays on Morning Edition. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Irwin Gratz. Join us again soon.